So, the plan for this morning is for us to complete the discussion of Shmuel HaNagid and then get a couple of Seder Divrei Torah in. Also, over there on the table, away from Chametz, are the Seder Companion that the Beit Midrash put out. It has 19 Divrei Torah on the Haggadah, different parts of the Haggadah. It has a Q&A section answering questions from teens. It has a Divrei Torah from your father in it as well.
So good.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, I can write for it in the future if they ask me.
If they let you.
Yeah.
Don't go there today, Alina.
Yeah, okay. So let's get started. Last time round, we gave a lot of background on the world of Shmuel HaNagid in basically 11th century Spain. We talked about the Arab population, the Berbers, and how the rise of the Berbers in particular gave more room for the rise of someone like Shmuel HaNagid in the Taifas in what would later become Spain. And we talked about his rise to political power, how his family fled from Cordoba to Malaga, but he became known as, well, first of all, he wanted to accomplish more for the Jewish people. He was attached to the Dayan in Malaga. He became known in academic circles. He had a dialogue with Ibn Khazm, this Muslim scholar. And then he moves to Granada, and he becomes known for his erudition. He becomes known for his linguistic skills. And he's writing letters on behalf of the vizier of the Berbers and becomes known for it. And while he gets into some trouble because some of the Jews are actually jealous of his success, he learns important lessons about not displaying his good fortune, and he rises in the ranks of government. And that's where we had left off, is he becomes the Minister of Finance in Granada. So I'm trying to figure out what I need to include and what I don't need to include, because I want to get to the Haggadah things as well. But his job grows. There's a fellow named Khabus, full name Khabus bin Maksin al-Muzaffar, which I'm probably butchering in terms of pronunciation, but he's not around to critique me on it. So he became the leader of Granada under the Berbers, and Shmuel is his minister of finance. The other way around. There's a fellow named Al-Arif Shmuel's been working for, who becomes Minister of Finance. Shmuel is working for him. But when Al-Arif dies, Al-Arif's son becomes the new Minister of Finance, and he's not up to the job, and Shmuel ends up taking the job that the Minister of Finance was supposed to be doing, but without claiming the credit. So he's doing all the work. And ultimately, Khabus figures it out and says, Shmuel, you're the one doing all the work. You're the one who's actually managing it. You become the vizier and the minister of finance. And so Shmuel HaNagid becomes minister of finance in Granada. And in source number one, I brought you a story from the Jewish Encyclopedia about Shmuel at this stage. In his exalted position, Shmuel remained the same pious and modest scholar and disarmed his enemies who could not forgive him his Jewish faith by his gentleness of manner and his liberality. The following is an illustration of his magnanimity. A fanatical Mohammedan dealer in spices. Someone asked me last time about when the Jewish Encyclopedia was written. The fact that they call a Muslim a Mohammedan tells you, I think, everything you need to know. It's pre-modern. So this spice dealer who lived near the caliph's palace once grossly offended Shmuel while accompanying the caliph. Incensed at the offense, the caliph commanded Shmuel to punish the fanatic by cutting out his tongue. Instead of executing this order, Shmuel made a present to the offender and thus gained his gratitude. When the caliph again noticed the seller of spices, he was astonished at the change and questioned Shmuel about it. I have torn out his angry tongue and given him instead a kind one. So Shmuel learns tact. He figures out how to deal with things. There's still a lot of political intrigue at this stage. There are a lot of people who are still jealous of him. This fellow Khabus, who is running Granada, has heirs who are all plotting against each other, and each one picks his own favorites among the government and his own allies. It's a big mess. There's also another Taifa called Almeria, and the leader of Almeria is a fellow named Bin Abbas. was a Muslim, not a Berber. And he saw the fact that Shmuel is the minister of finance in Granada as a sign of decline. And so he says, I want Almeria to cut ties with Granada because we don't want anything to do with them if they're going to have a Jew in their government. But Shmuel survives all of this. That leads to a war with Almeria, which is Shmuel's first experience of war. And they, making a long story short, Shmuel, first of all, in the end, the Almerians are routed, Granada wins, but Shmuel writes a long poem on his salvation, the salvation of Granada, and sends it to Jewish communities all around Europe and North Africa, establishing what becomes known as the Purim of Granada. I went looking online to see if I could find a text of the poem. I could not find a text of the poem, unfortunately. But this became a habit of his, to write victory poems crediting Hashem for their victory. And because Granada is so successful, Shmuel's position becomes solidified. There's more to talk about in terms of his reign and all of that, but I want to shift gears to talk about Shmuel as a Jewish leader, because that's our primary interest here. So, for all of his success among the Berbers, Shmuel holds himself apart. If you take a look at... no, I didn't bring it. I thought I had brought it on here, but I did not. So it's not here. Just kidding, unless it's at the end. It must have been on last week's, and I forgot to include it here. So it's not here. But in any case, Shmuel holds himself apart. He tolerates living among people whose values are very different from his own. He has to interact. He has to socialize. He's in the government. He believes that he is protected by the merit of the Avos, basically. He believes that our ancestral merit is what's protecting him as he does this. He dresses in the official manner of members of this Berber government. He wears the turban and all of that. But he never pretends to be something other than what he is. He identifies as a Jew and
amongst,
Israeli.
He doesn't live amongst the Jewish community in
Granada? No, he has to live, you know, with the Berbers. Yeah. He writes a lot of poetry, which we talked about last week, about a broad range of subjects. He writes about, he writes about drinking, he writes about faith in God, he writes about war, he writes about friendship and enemies, he writes love poems. He writes poems about Avelus. He writes about his dreams of Aliyah to Israel, which he never succeeds in doing. And the poems, as we said last time, are collected in three collections. There's the Ben Tehillim, which are the poems of Kedusha, of holiness. There's Ben Mishlei, and then there's Ben Kohelet. The Mishlei ones are about life and goals. The Kohelet ones are about death, the meaning of life. He gave shiur. There was a yeshiva in Granada, and he gave a regular shiur in the yeshiva. He exchanged letters with the leading figures of the time. There was a yeshiva in Israel called Gaon Yaakov, and we have letters that he wrote to the yeshiva there. He exchanged letters with the Jews in Egypt. In Egypt, the Jews actually had a tefillah they used to say for the Nagid and his family. Like the same way, like you have tefillos for, I don't know, the queen or the king or whatever. Like they would say a tefillah for Shmuel HaNagid and his family. He exchanged letters with the Jews of Kairouan in Tunisia. The main letters, though, we've mentioned before, were to Reb Haigon, his Rebbe in Bavel. And especially as he gets older, you see more of that. He wrote about Hebrew and Arabic grammar. He started a lexicon of Tanakh, explaining word roots and forms and so on, although he did not complete it. He wrote commentaries on books of Tanakh. We do not have the originals, but we see it quoted in different places. So, for example, in number 2, I brought you from Ibn Ezra, a comment that he makes in Parashas Kisisa. Moshe davens to Hashem after the Egel, and he says, Ana. Right? Ana chata ha'am hazeh chata agedola. The word ana does not admit easy translation, right? Today's Rosh Chodesh. Ana Hashem Hoshiana. How do you translate the word ana?
Please?
Yeah, please is usually what people say. But it's not so clear why that should be. Sometimes we say the word na means please, although sometimes it means now, which is a little bit confusing. So take a look at Ibn Ezra in source number 2. Amar HaNagid, he quotes Shmuel HaNagid. Shmuel HaNagid said, Ki ana mivula halamid, that it has a swallowed lamid. It should be al-na. Not ana, but al-na, upirish al-migzeras ho'il. And the word al doesn't mean don't, which is what I would have assumed, but rather it's from the word ho'il, which is to take an oath, to swear. So Ibn Ezra quotes him as saying, it's like Moshe is taking an oath to God with this request of, please don't destroy the nation. However, Ibn Ezra goes on to disagree, because why would you be quoted in Ibn Ezra unless he's disagreeing with you? So he says, with Zerachok, this is unlikely, and he goes on to give you his own explanation.
A please promise, like a please swear?
Sort of. It's, you know, when you want to say something in the Torah and show that you're serious, so you chay Hashem or chay Paro or something
right.
like that, that's like what he's doing.
Got it.
Yeah. He wrote a little bit on Gemara. We don't know exactly how much, and we don't have it anymore. Interestingly, according to what I've read, he emphasized the views of the Spanish Rabbanim as opposed to the Babylonian ones. He also wrote a work of which fragments survive called Hilchata Givurta, or Gibarvata, may be the more accurate way to write it. This is intended to be a universal book of halacha. Now, if you remember what we did among the Gaonim, we talked about how historically you didn't publish anything post-Gemara. There was no such thing as publishing. However, some of them saw particular needs, and they put out works of halacha. So that we saw the She'iltos of Rav Achoi, which he says is questions and answers on the Parsha for his son. And we talked about why that would be, why it's for his son. We saw the Halachos Gedolos, who collected halachos in particular passages of the Gemara. So this is intended to be more universal. If you take a look at number 3, this comes from his introduction to the Hilchata Gibarvata. You can see it's written in poem form, because he's living in 11th century Spain, so basically you can't, like, it's like you're living in a musical, so you have to say everything as a song. So, like, everything he writes has to be in poetic form. That's just the way you write.
The whole Sefer is in poem?
So, not the whole Sefer is in poem, no, but his introduction is in poem.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I'm going to work with my English translation here, but you can see the original as well. He's talking about why he wrote the book. And what he wants to do is to correct earlier Sifrei Halacha. What he has found, he says, is that Gaonim wrote things and their students recorded them or, you know, transferred them to a new form. And unfortunately, what they wrote was not really quality. They got things wrong. They made mistakes. And so he says, here I am in order to correct the mistakes of others. So he says, many wandered away from them, from the earlier statements of the Gaonim. In answering, and there it could mean declaring, unclear, the word in the Hebrew is b'ma'aneh, statements of learning in Torot, or teachings. And they taught people statements which contradict their learning, or their Talmud, and they wrote their pamphlets, including a few words which are friends to those who are crooked. This sounds much better in the Hebrew. And they are stated in the name of good and mighty leaders, statements that are not good. They keep accrediting the Gaonim with things the Gaonim didn't say, things that are simply wrong. Yeah. And therefore, I am researching in the religion of Hashem according to my abilities and intellect, further research. And I mention the errors to remove them and rights to establish the correct statements. And I rely in what I will note and write upon the choice statements of the Gaonim and Rav Hai, greatest of them all, I set for me his wonders for crowns of splendor. This is just a piece of it. It's actually available online. I didn't put the link. Oh well. But it is, you can find that online. He brings a lot of Yerushalmi, interestingly, in his writing. Like we said, he quotes the Gaonim. Some of it exists, as I said, in fragments, and some of it is quoted centuries later by Rishonim. So you find his writing, which he's writing again in the 11th century, surfacing in the 13th and 14th centuries. Ramban quotes it, the Balamor of Zrachi Halevi quotes it, Sefer HaEshkol quotes it, the Sefer HaItim quotes it. That's actually where we're going to get source number 4. Is going to come, well, we'll take a look. This is a piece in the Sefer Ha'itim, which is, as I wrote there, written by Rabbi Yehuda of Barcelona in 12th century Spain, quoting Shmuel Hanagid. So he says, and Mar Rav Yehudai said, this is Shmuel Hanagid quoting Rav Yehudai Gaon. So he says, Rav Yehudai Gaon said, one who recites Kedushin, remember that we said he might have been the author of the Halachos Gedolos. He might be the Bahag. We had a whole discussion about that. One who recites Kiddush for his household, and then he comes to people who know how to recite Kiddush, may not recite Kiddush for them. Right? Meaning, on Shabbos. This is just a random halacha that I pulled out. On Shabbos, you make Kiddush for yourself, then somebody else needs their Kiddush, it's too late. You already said Kiddush. If they know how to recite Kiddush. And that's what Shmuel HaNagid now clarifies. The Kasav HaNagid Hachi, and the Nagid wrote thus, I have learned from my masters who said that the same is so for Havdalah and all blessings on mitzvos, meaning it's not just about Kiddush. The same applies for any other bracha on a mitzvah. I picked up my lulav already, so I can't now bench lulav for somebody else, things like that. As long as one has fulfilled one's obligation and they know how to recite Kiddush. So if they don't know how to recite Kiddush, I am able to say Kiddush for them. Right? That hopefully people are familiar with. There's a story about a rav, and I don't remember which rav anymore, that he used to take a long time getting home from shul Friday night because he would go to different people's houses and make Kiddush for them because they couldn't say Kiddush for themselves. I'm sure his wife appreciated it. But the idea here is what we call arevos, right? Kol Yisrael areven zeh bazeh. All of us are responsible for each other, so Rav Soloveitchik explained, what that means is, my mitzvah obligation is not complete as long as there is somebody else whose mitzvah obligation remains unfulfilled. Mm-hmm. Even though I made Kiddush, Kiddush is still relevant for me until everybody has made Kiddush. And therefore, if that person knows how to make the bracha, they should be making it themselves, but if they don't, I can recite this bracha, even though it's not for a mitzvah for me at all, on their behalf. That's the logic that's underpinning this. But what I'm bringing this to show you is simply that Rabbi Yehuda of Barcelona in his Sefer Ha'itim is quoting Shmuel HaNagid, a century later. You follow? Another example, just to show how he gets quoted, Rabbeinu Asher. Rabbeinu Asher, also known as the Rosh. We're going to spend a lot of time on him, because you have to. He is one of the most important figures in halacha, period, ever in history. Because in the end of the 13th century, he lives in Germany and is one of the leading poskim in Germany. And then he flees Germany due to persecution. There were pogroms. It was a horrible time. The Mordechai was executed. Like, it was not a good time. And he flees in 1300 and goes to Spain. And he becomes one of the leading poskim in Spain. Which means you have a leader in Ashkenaz. Right. Who goes over to Sfard, and his son is the author of the Tur, which is a brand new way to codify halacha that leads to the Shulchan Aruch ultimately. He's one of the biggest figures we have. So the Rosh, Rabbeinu Asher, is discussing the question of requiring a minyan for the brachos made under the chuppah. And again, just my translation, he quotes Rav Achai first. Rav Achai, meaning Rav Achai who never became a Gaon, the one from the She'iltos, wrote that 10 are required for the blessing of Kiddushin. The brachos under the chuppah, you need 10 for those opening brachos of Kiddushin. Rabbeinu Shmuel HaNagid disagreed with him, saying only the blessings of marriage require 10. The Sheva brachos need 10, as the requirement of 10 was only mentioned for these. Further, Kiddushin is in front of two witnesses, and you require 10? So Shmuel HaNagid says no. You know, we get confused because we do Kiddushin and Nisuin together under the chuppah. But back in the day, they could be up to a year apart. So the Kiddushin ritual, says Shmuel HaNagid, that's where he gives her the ring, right? And you have a bracha to make with it. He says, that can be done with two witnesses. You don't need a minyan for that. The Sheva brachos that we say under the chuppah, that requires a minyan. But not the first one. That's Shmuel HaNagid's position. And then the Rosh, like Ibn Ezra before, goes on to disagree with him, and he says, actually, I think Rav Achai is right. I think you need a minyan for Kiddushin as well, he says. But I bring it just to show you that he's under consideration by the great Rabbeinu Asher, who is living 200 years later.
And they're quoting from this sefer that he wrote, this
Hilchata. Probably from Hilchata Gibarata. That's probably where he would have gotten it. If you flip the page to source number 6, this is the Me'iri. The Me'iri is fascinating in his own right, and I would hope we would spend some time on him as well. Among other things, the Me'iri wrote on Gemara. He was one of the Rishonim whose words were taken very, very seriously by the other Rishonim. But his manuscript for a lot of what he wrote disappeared until, I think, the late 19th, early 20th century. We knew he existed, but we didn't have his writing other than what got quoted, and then suddenly we had his writing. And it caused a major tumult in the halachic world of, what do I do now? Because Rishon, who we know was of standing, his work survives, and then what if it disagrees with something that's in the Shulchan Aruch? Who do we follow? And that was a fascinating debate in its own right. I think it was the Chazon Ish who said, it doesn't matter. We have the Sfarim that Hashem wants us to have. We make a decision based on that, and you don't overturn it because something shows up later. I think it was the Chazon Ish who said that.
We never do that?
Except when we do.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. More or less, except when we do. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the Me'iri, in his introduction to Pirkei Avos, gives a record of the Mesorah. You know, who were the leaders of Torah in different times? Because Pirkei Avos begins with Mesorah le'Yoshua, Yoshua le'Zakenim, Zakenim le'Neviim. So he's going to give you a Mesorah. So look at what he has here. He says, and again, I'll read my translation. And in Rav Hai Gaon's time was Rabbi Shmuel ben Chofni. We didn't talk about him, but he was one of the Gaonim. The Me'iri does not like him. He also compiled many books, but one should not rely on them so much. Not a fan. Mm. Also at the end of his time, meaning Rav Hai Gaon's time, was the Nagid, Rabbi Shmuel HaLevi. He was from Cordoba. He fled due to persecution to Malaga. And because of his great interventions with the government, it developed that he became close to the throne in Granada. And he also compiled a book on the entire Talmud called Hilchata Gibarvata in the year 1055, he says. And these three, Rabbeinu Hananel, who was in Kirwan, Rabbeinu Nissim, who I think was also in Kirwan, but whom that might not have been, and Rabbi Shmuel HaNagid were the first generations after the Gaonim and were called Rabbanim. That's the title that the Me'iri uses for that era. But those three are the giants of this post-Gaonic period. You follow? So there's another work that gets credited to him, but it's thought to not really be his, but I mention it because it gets credited to him. If you were to open a standard Vilna Shas, the Vilna printing of the Gemara is the one that is used in a standard edition Gemara. So if you were to open Maseches Brachos, the way they work is that you have Brachos and Gemara Brachos in the beginning of the Masechta, and then the end of the Masechta, the end of the volume, I should say, the end of the volume has the rest of the Mishnayos and Seder Zraim. Because if you know the way that the Gemara works and the Mishnah works, the first part of Shas is Seder Zraim, which is largely about agriculture. Most of that does not have Talmud Bavli, right? The Chachamim and Bavel are not paskening things for areas of halacha. They have zero to do with, right? Trumos, Maestros, Shvias, you know, Maestro Sheni, you know, it's not relevant. Granted, some of it is, like Maseches Chala, for example, is in there, and Arla is in there. Nonetheless, we have Yerushalmi, we don't have Bavli. So what you'll see in your standard Talmud Bavli is that the first part of the volume is Maseches Brachos, which is the first one in Zraim, and then the end of it is just the Mishnayos from Seder Zraim with commentary on them. But in the middle, you get this thing called Mevo HaTalmud, which is literally introduction to or foreword of the Talmud. And it'll say in your standard Vilna Shas, Mevo HaTalmud L'Rabbi Shmuel HaNagid. Because for a very long time, it was believed that he had written it. What is it? It's basically about the origin of Shas and defines certain words, like what does Mishnah mean? What does Gemara mean? Why is this called Mishnah? Why is it called Gemara? What's a Tana? What's an Amora? Things like that. And it's credited to him. I gave you an example of it in source number 7, just translated at the beginning. The author said, Amar Machaber, the Talmud is split into two parts, Mishnah, an explanation of the Mishnah. The Mishnah is what is called the spoken Torah. This is the foundation of Torah recorded from Moshe Rabbeinu until the days of Rabbeinu HaKadosh, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. dot, dot, dot. It's giving you like a history of things. So, like I said, it's credited to him, but historians point out that the style is not really like his. There's a sefer called Hilchot Hanagid by Mordechai Margolyos. Very interesting sefer with a very interesting origin, but not for right now. But he points out, first of all, that the opening of it actually comes from Rav Shmuel Bar Chofni Gaon, who we mentioned the Meiri not liking in source number 6. And when Shmuel Hanagid quotes somebody, he always names his source. He doesn't just bring it as though it's his own. You saw that in number four, we quoted Marav Yehudai. He's very clear about what his sources are. That's number one. Number two, it's not his style. Shmuel Hanagid wanted to expand and bring all the material related to his subject. He wasn't someone who was going to abbreviate. That just wasn't his way. It's credited to somebody else named Shmuel ben Chananya Hamagid of Cairo. And you could see how you get confused, right? Shmuel Hamagid, Shmuel Hanagid. Yeah, you get that happens. He also wrote against the Quran. He wrote a treatise criticizing the Quran, identifying problems in the text, like contradictions in it. Take a look at source number 8 from Eliyahu Ashtor, The Jews of Muslim Spain. Yet his most amazing achievement surely was the writing of a treatise against the Quran. Amazing not because like it's like such a hard thing to do, but amazing because how do you get away with that living in Muslim Spain? Most of the writings about Islam by Jewish scholars were comprehensive theological essays or polemics defending Judaism against the arguments of the Muslims, like think Kuzari, right? Who sought to demonstrate from the Bible that Muhammad was a real prophet and so on. But the Jews were careful not to denigrate the sacred book of the Muslims. And then along came Shmuel to point out the Quran's contradictions and errors. He called attention to one section where it is stated the world was created in 8 days. In another area, it says it's created in 6 days. And the Muslims all have their way of dealing with these things, you know.
It's not like we don't have that.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't compare us to them, but I will say that, you know, they have their answers. You know, if you learn Islam, you know, which I'm not, you know, pushing, but they have this concept of hadith where they have new lessons that are added and explanations for what came before and ways to harmonize things. They have this hadith is more authoritative, this hadith is less authoritative. It should sound very familiar. Lahabdil, but it should sound familiar. The Muslims were outraged that he did this, but he was basically untouchable. Ibn Hazm, who was his acquaintance from when they were young, wrote against him very harshly and attacked the Torah for its apparent contradictions and for the things that great figures in the Torah do that sure look sketchy. And, you know, Ibn Hazm, the tone of the debate changes. Originally, the debates between them are like fun and challenging, but he's bitter and angry at this point. But Shmuel survives it. Shmuel is communal leader. There were about 5,000 Jews in Granada at that time, and Shmuel is the one in charge of the community. He's the chief dayan for disputes. He is the disciplinarian for troublemakers. He supports the yeshivot. He encourages the growing scholars of the day. And like I said, he gave shir in yeshiva. He's just like everything. Really outstanding. I have a section here about his life, his career as a general also. But I'm thinking that we need to also get to Haggadah things, and it's already 11:30. Mm-hmm. So we don't need to continue with it after Pesach, because by that time people will be like, Shmuel who? But Shmuel was a general. He fought wars. He dealt with assassination attempts and had quite the career in that regard.
How do you have time to write all this stuff and also be the finance minister and go to war?
I think probably because there was no social media, so you had a lot more time on his hands. That's what I would guess. He passes away in the spring of 1056. And interestingly, he is mourned by Jews and by Muslims. He is eulogized as having achieved the Keser Torah, the Keser Malchus, the Keser Kahuna, because he's a Levi, and the Keser Shem Tov. And his son Joseph actually took over for him and had a career of his own as the Nagid. But Shmuel was really outstanding. Just one piece from my notes that jumps out at me was that in the fall of 1047, Granada had just defeated this area called Randa. And they united a whole bunch of smaller Berber tribes and created a new caliphate to rival the caliphate that was based in Seville. Shmuel wrote the text for the crowning of the caliph. Like the official correspondence and all of that, he was the one who did that in Islamic style, interestingly.
Is Muslim a city in Spain? Muslim?
No. Where do you read it?
No, because...
Oh, the Jews of Muslims. No. It was Muslim. In other words, you had Christian Spain and Muslim Spain.
M-U-S.
So this is the way, Ashtar wrote this decades ago, and it's true that today it's become pretty standard to do M-U-S-L-I-M, but, for a long time it was M-O-S-L-E-M. I think even when I was growing up, I think it was M-O-S-L-E-M was a very popular spelling. But yeah, it's become less so over the years. But you go back further and you find Mohammedan, you find Saracen. They had different terms that were used. Okay.
When did secular Jew type of mix start to die off?
So he was rare. You can't think of him as representing a class of people who all did this. There were some who did, but I would say that he was the exception in his own day as well. The 5,000 Jews in Granada were not all like this. There's a lot of discussion. I mentioned it, I think, briefly at some point about what was called convivencia. There are historians who believe that at this time, the Jews, the Muslims, the Christians all got along together and, sang kumbaya and, had marshmallows over the campfire. So we know that the Jews in Morocco developed what's called the Mela, which is an early form of the ghetto. I don't think in the Taifas you had that, but I'm not sure. But in terms of the overall idea that Jews and Muslims and Christians got along, that's been disputed by historians for the last 60 or 70 years. The original version was, this is a golden age and everybody's getting along. Not necessarily. It's under heavy dispute.
So Jews like the Avar Benel, who's obviously not during this time period, correct, but also worked in the palace or whatever, like that was also unique? Or in those days it changed?
So what happens over time, and it happens in different areas at different times, is that the leaders valued Jewish connections to other Jews elsewhere as both a matter of finance, because there's capital available, and as a means of political connections in other lands. And so Jews end up being elevated to the court of the king, the caliph, whoever it is, to a position of influence where the government hopes to use what they can offer to their advantage. So that happens in Poland in the 13th, 14th, 15th centuries. It happens in Turkey after the expulsion from Spain. At different times, it happens in different places. I don't have the impression it was going on in Spain at this point, but I don't know from that, for sure. Like I always say about all this, and I said it when we started this whole Giants of series, my history comes from whatever reading I've done. I never studied history in school. I'm not a professional historian. So I'm just, it's things that I've read that fit together. Okay? Mm-hmm. All right, let's do Haggadah.